it's, I mean, you can't really state you're not ready if you're still getting paid, because you're an essential worker.
Okay, but this is like a enough.
It's about following up, holding them accountable. They're not accountable the same way we voted them in, vote them out.
You know, we shouldn't assume that the sports world is somehow intrinsically militaristic, and we should reject it the way a vegetarian might reject a leg of lamb.
Democrats were aiming to win one office. I know Trump is a terrible person, and we have to get rid of him. And since that's all they were aiming for, that's all they got.
This is the best of COVID Race and Democracy, a collective effort by Pacifica producers across the network that has been airing since June 2020. I'm your host, Ann Garrison.
We turn our attention to California, specifically a city in Contra Costa, where a renter has been feeling harassed by her landlord since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic, even though she says that she has informed him from the beginning that she wasn't going to be able to pay due to COVID-19. She has chosen to remain anonymous. We will call her Yannette. Yannette is self-employed and her work is cleaning houses. The city she lives in and the county have an eviction moratorium until September 2020. While there are requirements she has as a tenant to document her income losses and to notify the landlord in time if she can't pay rent, she feels she has been doing so. The following audio documentary recordings we will hear came from Yannette directly and are being used with her permission. They highlight not only the struggle that her and her daughter face as renters affected by the pandemic, but also show their struggle and courage to make sure they exert their right to protect themselves in their own home. One of the times that the landlord arrived to her home, Yannette and her 12-year-old child called 911, and they recorded themselves doing so. These are short excerpts of the call.
I want to file a report.
What are you reporting?
Abuse locally, because he's the landlord of the apartments and we feel like he's going to come at any moment because he's done that before and we feel like he's going to do that again. I am 12 and he was talking to me in a way that I really didn't like. He was cussing and he was telling me to shut up and I told him to stop and he was like, I don't care who you are in this. And now I don't feel safe sleeping here because I am scared he's going to come and, like, do something to us, to me and my mom. I don't feel safe. He comes whenever he wants sometimes. Like, let's say an hour ago, he came and he banged on the window. He was banging, and my mom was taking a shower, and I was in the room. And, like, that's what makes me really unsafe because he was banging and banging on the door and on the window and on the walls and, like, looking through our window room, and it's made me feel real unsafe, and I feel like he's going to do that while we're sleeping, and I really don't want him to do that.
At the end of this 911 call, the operator does take down their phone numbers and lets them know that an officer will be calling them. The following audio is from a video taken when two people came to their door on behalf of the landlord. The tenant, Yannette, thinks that they may be the landlord's sons. They stand at the door and ask her for more documentation of loss of income, which she says she has sent already by email, and they tell her that it isn't enough.
Those documents don't really state that you're not getting a loss in. Mm-hmm.
Okay, you know what? You know what? I'll figure out now this. I text you, and I tell you, I'll let you know when I'm ready. So I'm not ready yet.
But it's not, you can't really state you're not ready if you're still getting paid, because you're an essential worker.
Okay, but this is like a enough. I don't know why you come, like, whatever you guys want, so this is not good.
Well, it's not that whatever okay, we well, want. I mean, we need
yeah,
the
I know, I understand that.
So,
and I understand, so I got your phone call, I text you back, and you never answer, so.
You just sent a text, you didn't call back.
And I text like you times. Back. When you guys don't want to answer my text, you guys don't do it. So?
Well, I mean, if
you, okay, you know what? I'm not going to talk to you guys today. I'll let you know when I'm ready.
But, I mean, you need to show us proper payment. I mean,
in a letter dated April 6, 2020, Yannette's landlord sent a 24-hour notice of intent to enter premises for the next day between noon and 4 p.m. The reason given on the notice is simply inspect the premises. We hear the landlord upon entry to their home in this next clip. The landlord is holding his phone out like he either is recording or is appearing to be taking video. The tenants were taking their own video, and here are some of the sounds as he wanders their home.
To inspect that unit? Yeah.
Why do you want to inspect? I don't understand why you are here all the time. You come whatever you want. That's
yeah,
not
you,
nice.
You banged on the door last time. You think that didn't scare us? You were banging on the window.
In the
you think that's okay?
Windows, door. That's not nice.
And you were cussing at her, and we recorded it.
Okay, we have a call. That's fine.
Go check. There's no one living here.
We don't get it. Why are you guys always here?
While Yannette and her 12-year-old daughter have been brave with sharing this audio, and they've been courageous with wanting to share their story to help others, it's important to note that the emotional trauma that they are experiencing has taken a very serious toll on them, including loss of sleep and feeling unsafe in their own home. We want to make sure that Yannette and her daughter know we're grateful they shared their story. Thank you to you both. Since this story is from Contra Costa, California, we decided to talk to Delia Pedrosa, local fair housing advocate, as to what people can do if they feel they're being harassed by their landlord.
Sometimes you have to call, for example, the outreach, the 211. They have a tremendous list of resources where they can provide them with, you know, the best ones for the tenant to call and get help right away. The key here is to call. Call and reach out to any resources to get to the right agency. If this continues on, you know, as far as any harassment happening by their landlords, the best thing that they can do is right away call the police, because the shelter in place legal order, there is a recital there that the sheriffs will enforce the shelter in place and law enforcement. So they can call one or the other. And once they connect to someone that can help them, maybe, you know, help them get a restraining order together.
Delia also noted that she sees that the state is already preparing for what could possibly be a flood of evictions and unlawful detainers. We want to thank Delia and all others who are working to help renters in this time of crisis. As listeners, we all can do our part by making sure we understand what's happening. And then if we got a little bit extra in us, find out what's happening in our local communities and report. For Pacifica Radio, this has been Sarah Blanco. Special thanks to producer Free Will and Franklin.
Can U.S. team sports be separated from U.S. militarism? The U.S. claims the inherent right to rule the world, and the Pentagon divides it into five geographic commands, plus cyber, special operations, transportation, strategic, and now space commands. The U.S. also lavishly celebrates its military at sporting events, most of all, basketball and football. Will the current sports activism around racial injustice ever extend to the global neocolonial racial injustice that European elites continue to impose on Latin America, Africa, and East and South Asia? Nation Magazine sports editor Dave Zirin is here to help us think about that. Dave, thanks for joining COVID Race and Democracy.
Oh, thanks for having me.
We're going to start by playing a bit of George Carlin on baseball and football. I'm sure you know this routine very well, but our listeners might not.
Baseball is a 19th century pastoral game. Football is a 20th century technological struggle. Baseball is played on the diamond, in a park, the baseball park. Football is played on a gridiron in a stadium, sometimes called Soldier Field or War Memorial Stadium. Baseball begins in the spring, the season of new life. Football begins in the fall when everything is dying. In football, you wear a helmet.
In baseball, you wear a cap.
Football is concerned with downs. What down is it?
Baseball is concerned with ups. Who's up? Are you up? I'm not up. He's up.
In football, the specialist comes in to kick.
In baseball, the specialist comes in to relieve someone.
In football, you receive a penalty. In baseball, you make an error. Whoops. Football has hitting, clipping, spearing, blocking, piling on, late hitting, unnecessary roughness, and personal fouls. Baseball has the sacrifice. Football is played in any kind of weather. Rain, sleet, snow, hail, mud. Can't read the numbers on the field, can't read the yard markers, can't read the players' numbers. The struggle will continue. In baseball, if it rains, we don't come out to play. I can't come out to play. It's raining out. Baseball has a seventh inning stretch. Football has the 2-minute warning. Baseball has no time limit. We don't know when it's going to end. We might have extra innings. Football is rigidly timed and it will end even if we have to go to sudden death. In baseball, during the game in the stands, there's kind of a picnic feeling. Emotions may run high or low, but there's not that much unpleasantness. In football, in the stands during the game, you can be sure that at least 27 times you were perfectly capable of taking the life of a fellow human being. Preferably a stranger. And finally, the objectives of the two games are totally different. In football, the object is for the quarterback, otherwise known as the field general, to be on target with his aerial assault, riddling the defense by hitting his receivers with deadly accuracy, in spite of the blitz, even if he has to use the shotgun. With short bullet passes and long bombs, he marches his troops into enemy territory, balancing this aerial assault with a sustained ground attack which punches holes in the forward wall of the enemy's defensive line.
Okay, Dave Zirin, do you think Carlin nailed the essence of America's most popular sport?
I really do think that George Carlin did, because there's so much militarism that's baked into the cake of football in this country. I mean, football really begins at the start of the U.S. imperial project, and it was something that was popularized by Teddy Roosevelt. I mean, and so you have this one person, Teddy Roosevelt, who, of course, was very famous before he was ever president, who was the number one cheerleader of both empire and football. And that's not just a coincidence, because he thought one would prepare young people to enact the other. Now, that being said, I don't think football has to be so militaristic. It could certainly be less militaristic than it currently is, but it's such a feature of football. It's not a bug.
Last January, when the Pentagon assassinated Iran's hero, General Qasem Soleimani, Colin Kaepernick made headlines simply by tweeting, quote, "America has always sanctioned and besieged black and brown bodies, both at home and abroad. American militarism is the weapon wielded by American imperialism to enforce its policing and plundering of the non-white world." There's nothing new about American terrorist attacks against black and brown people for the expansion of American imperialism. That's what he tweeted most eloquently, but he still seems to be putting in all the hours it takes in the gym and on the field to play football, still hoping for that call back into the NFL. So he doesn't seem to believe that the sport is inseparable from its militarist, imperialist trappings. Do you think more players will be able to develop and express a similar global and historical understanding of racial injustice and survive in the game?
Well, we've seen it in the past. There were certainly players who were against the war in Vietnam, most famously Dave Megacy, who quit the NFL in his prime because he believed that the war in Vietnam and the National Football League were really one and the same, and that professional football and college football was gearing people up for war. And then also during the quote-unquote war on terror, specifically the war in Iraq, you had players like Scott Fujita, Adelius Thomas, and other football players speak out against war. So, I mean, it's certainly something that's real. You know, these players, we have to remember, are part of the world. They don't, you know, exist on a separate planet called Planet Athlete, and then they come down and entertain us and then go on their spaceships and return. These are people who are part of the world. And when there are movements against war, they're affected by those movements. What I think we have to remember is that it always starts with the movement. It always starts with what's happening off the field. And we shouldn't expect athletes to develop a kind of political consciousness independent of movements and ideas developing away from the field of play.
Do you think the rules of the game can remain in place without all the military packaging? I'm talking mostly about basketball and football, most of all football, since these two sports are most given to combat and territorial metaphors and also seem most saturated with military display and recruiting.
Yeah, I mean, I think first and foremost, in our incredibly warlike society, every instrument of pop culture, not just sports, can be geared towards war efforts. And we've seen that. And baseball has a rich history of being part of war efforts in this country and imperial efforts. I mean, from Latin America to East Asia to World War II and the amount of players who enlisted and did all sorts of things for the USO and the like. I mean, war and baseball, I mean, baseball is not somehow pure and football is impure. Like, that's just not, the 20th century refutes that pretty hard. But I do think, though, it is possible, certainly, that in a different kind of society, that you could have these sports and not have them dominated by war. And play could happen for the sake of play, for the sake of joy, for the sake of exercise. And you wouldn't have the kind of foghorn of militarism that exists way too often in professional and often collegiate sports.
I was getting optimistic about NBA activism till 9/11, when inside the NBA hit bottom with all the 9/11 military jingoism, but without mentioning that the U.S.-led, quote, global war on terrorism, unquote, has displaced at least 37 million people in 8 countries since 2001, or that it's left at least 800,000 people dead at a cost of $6.4 trillion to U.S. taxpayers. This is according to the report, quote, Creating Refugees, Displacement Caused by the United States Post-9/11 Wars, unquote, released by Brown University scholars on September 8. Inside the NBA is one of my favorite TV shows, but I had to turn it off on 9/11. I couldn't take it. Did you see it?
Well, I honestly don't remember. I mean, it's been almost 20 years, and I do remember consuming a tremendous amount of sports media after 9/11, and so I assume inside the NBA is just very similar to what I saw elsewhere, which was like the volume just cranked up of people who were there to turn tragedy into war, or were there to turn what happened at 9/11 into a massive mobilization to bomb and occupy other countries. I mean, it was a terrible tragedy and a terrible misuse of sports at that time. And, you know, I think it's so important that we need to have an anti-war movement in this country, you know, that's consistent, because otherwise, when these conflagrations take place, we'll find ourselves with, you know, some of the things that we look to for escape, like sports, all of a sudden mobilized against us, and not only us, but the people of the world who bear the brunt of U.S. militarism.
Eloquent. Is there anything else you'd like to say about this?
Just that, like, I think we should fight for a better sports world. You know, we shouldn't assume that the sports world is somehow intrinsically militaristic, and we should reject it the way a vegetarian might reject a leg of lamb. I think we should get away from that mentality. And think instead of rejecting sports, how we can reclaim it. Because there's a lot of good in sports. You know, we've got to remember that. Like, sports has given us a lot of things that we do want to reject, but it's also given us Muhammad Ali. It's given us Billie Jean King. It's given us Colin Kaepernick. And it's given us some moments of absolute poetry. And so, just like I would say this about art as well, but we shouldn't reject sports. We should try to reclaim it.
Oh, yeah, well, one thing I like about it is that you have to play by the rules to win.
Very different from politics.
Yes, yes. Okay, David Zirin, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And that was Nation Magazine sports editor David Zirin. His work can be found on his website, edgeofsports.com, and on the Nation website.
You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy. Find out more about our work at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
This is Steve Zeltzer with Pacifica on the program COVID, Race, and Democracy. The past few months, the threat of a coup in the United States was being taken seriously by millions of people and what working people in the labor movement should do about any attempted coup. In Vermont, at the state convention of the Vermont AFL-CIO on November 21st, delegates met and debated the proposed call for a statewide general strike. Despite efforts of the national AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka to stop any vote on this issue, the delegates overwhelmingly endorsed taking general strike if a coup took place. I interviewed Vermont President David Van Dusen about their action and what working people have to do to defend democracy.
My name is David Van Dusen. I'm president of the Vermont AFL-CIO. I've been involved with the labor movement for 20 plus years now. Before the election, before November 3rd, our own senator, who we have a very good relationship with, Bernie Sanders, you may have heard of him. He was trumpeting in public, being a siren, a warning that he felt the signs were there that even with Trump losing the election, he would seek to stay in office. We took those warnings very seriously as a labor council. We brought the question to our members. We heard from many different rank and file people. We heard from many different unions and different points of view. And at the end of the day, our members feel the same way as I do, that we must defend democracy at all costs. And they overwhelmingly voted to authorize us, their executive board, to call for a general strike here in Vermont if Trump refuses to leave the White House and if we are in a coup type situation. We must defend democracy. I spoke on a phone call some weeks ago after the election with President Trumka. I asked him point blank if we are prepared as an organization for a national general strike in the event of a coup. He personally told me that no options are off the table. So here in Vermont, we're doing what we have to do. You don't snap your fingers and have a general strike. It takes hard work to do this and preparation and organizing. We have the authorization from our members to do such work in preparation. We are doing that now. We're going to focus on key communities, definitely our largest city, Burlington, and other communities around the state as well. We've already engaged in the political discussion with elected leaders, and we very strongly feel that if there is a coup, we will not be standing alone. We will be standing with many allies, including elected officials here in Vermont.
We're talking with Dane Van Dusen, who is president of the Vermont AFL-CIO.
We're facing a 1930s type situation with the unprecedented levels of unemployment that we have now, the pandemic raging and on the rise everywhere. This is a crisis situation. Put on top of that, a potential coup, and we have never seen anything like this in the history of the United States. So we know what the answer is. We need a New Deal type recovery. There's economic recovery. There is no two ways about it. Even if we get the vaccine out and distributed by the spring, we are still going to be in serious economic trouble. So we need to see massive public investment in our infrastructure, in our schools, in our communities. We need that to come from the feds. And where the feds won't lead, we need the states to lead. In Vermont, the AFL-CIO, we've been fighting to get Green New Deal on the agenda and aspects of Green New Deal here in our capital, Montpelier. And we need that fight to happen in Washington as well. We need to pressure Biden. Once we get him in the White House, we need to be sure to keep up the fight and keep up the struggle to make sure he follows through what he said on the campaign trail. And that should not be taken for granted. But we're not going to make progress on single payer, on a Green New Deal, on livable wages, any of it, unless we put serious pressure on the capitalist class and on the Democratic Party. So even if we get Trump thrown out of office, which the voters said we have to do, and we have to do whatever it takes to get him out, even after that, we're only going to make progress with this Democratic Party if we are pressuring them. We need to be in the streets, we need to have an outside game, and we need to have a long game. The days of us relying on backroom deals with bigwigs from the Democratic Party should need to be over. That strategy has failed. It has failed time and time again. And we cannot allow ourselves to be lulled into subservience under a new administration. So the struggle will be very real. We need to see unions being active on levels that are unprecedented in this country since the Great Depression. And that's what it's going to take to win. We need to build a very deep democracy within our labor movement if we're going to get the kind of buy-in and the kind of action needed out of the millions of union members in this country in order to make fundamental social change in this country. That is hard because a lot of our inherited structures and bylaws are frankly not very democratic. At our last convention, where we passed the general strike authorization vote, we also passed a number of constitutional changes to our labor body. We want to be an example for the country to expand the amount of delegates, to expand the amount of participation that we'll have in these decision-making bodies and in these conventions. And let's be real. The best case scenario is that enough pressure is brought to bear where Trump does not go the next step with his coup. Trump is removed from office. This is the best case scenario. And under that case scenario, there will be low-grade violence emanating from fascists across this country for the next 4 years plus. That is a fact. We've seen that happen already in the Pacific Northwest. We've seen it in the Midwest. We've seen that trend develop over the last 4 years. And it, what started off as lone wolf attacks, think of the guy in Florida with the pipe bombs, has become organized groups taking violent acts, which is a qualitatively different thing. Labor needs to be prepared to defend the left, to defend workers, to defend unions in the face of violence. And that's not going to be a peaceful sit-in. We need to do whatever it takes to make sure our members and those who are fighting for progressive change are made to feel safe. Here in Vermont, we are chartering a union motorcycle club who would have some security responsibilities in the event that a threat was posed to us.
We've been talking with Dave Van Dusen. He's president of the state AFL-CIO in Vermont. Thanks for joining us on Pacifica.
October 9 marks 53 years since Che Guevara was executed by the U.S.-backed Bolivian army. But today, Che's legacy as a revolutionary and medical doctor lives on. The death rate from COVID-19 is more than 60 times higher in the U.S. than in Cuba. The country has effectively battled the coronavirus through its exemplary public health system and its international medical partnerships. Next up, Pacifica's Ken Yale speaks with Don Fitz about how Che's vision helped shape the Cuban medical system and about responses to COVID-19 in Cuba that are fundamentally different than those in the U.S.
You published an article entitled How Che Guevara Taught Cuba to Confront COVID-19, but Che died in 1967. So what did you mean by that?
Well, of course, Che Guevara had no idea that COVID-19 would ever happen, but what he did know was how to completely revolutionize medicine. When he was a young man, he took time out of medical school to go visit a leper colony in Peru. It was an event that totally changed his life. He felt it was absolutely necessary to live with the people and understand the people that you're helping. He was critical in initiating for the Cuban Revolution what we would call 60 years later Medicare for All. The first goal of the revolution was to establish medical care throughout Cuba to everybody. Cuba established the rural medical service and required that all graduates of medical school work for 2 years in the rural areas. Che inspired a whole generation of doctors to do this. What Che did was to help develop the idea that physicians should be helping people and not just making money. And Che understood the need to totally change the medical system. The changes kept on going through Cuba for 60 years, and it was able to respond to COVID-19 much better than the United States was.
According to Johns Hopkins, the U.S. death rate from COVID-19 is more than 60 times higher than Cuba's. How has Cuba responded to the coronavirus and done so much to protect the health and well-being of their people?
They immediately cut down on tourism, which was extremely difficult for Cuba because tourism is a major source of income for Cuba. But despite that, they cut down. They required people to wear masks. They did contact tracing when there were just a few people who had COVID-19 in Cuba. They looked at hotspots in Cuba where there was a lot of COVID-19. And where there was, they restricted travel in and out of these areas. They did something in hospitals, which I have never heard of being done in other countries. Cuban doctors actually were quarantined for 45-day stretches at a time before they could go back. In the urban areas, every physician can visit a home by walking to it, because there's that many There's one doctor in the neighborhood for every 1,500 or so residents. In the rural areas, the doctors will travel by bicycle or donkey or horse in order to reach everybody in the community. If it's really low populated, they might get a car, but those are really lucky physicians. In the U.S., if you think you have symptoms of COVID-19, you have to contact the medical establishment, whether it's a doctor's office, a clinic, or whatever. It's the responsibility of the patient to do that. In Cuba, it's the opposite direction. The medical staff and the medical students go out to every neighborhood in the country, whether city or rural, and check on every single person and see what they need. Do they have symptoms of COVID-19? Do they need to be checked out by a physician or hospital more thoroughly? Does a person not have enough food because they can't get out of the house because they're quarantined? Whatever the problems people have, the doctor's office works with the other community organizations to make sure that every single person is taken care of in connection with COVID-19 and people are not left uncared for. The other thing which is totally different about Cuban medicine is that every part of it's integrated. In the United States, there's 50 sets of rules. Each state has its own rules. People can follow them or not, and sometimes they just totally ignore them. In Cuba, that's not at all the case. There's one protocol which was developed by the Ministry of Health that applies to urban areas to rural areas, and they'll have regular meetings between physicians and clinic doctors, and they will be talking about, are there high rates of COVID-19? What sort of problems do people have? Do the medical students have stress? Do the doctors and nurses, do they have stress? And each clinic then reports that to the national organization, and the national organization modifies the policies. So that, in a sense, every single person in Cuba has a part in developing the COVID policy, because the COVID policy comes from the clinics, which comes from the doctors, which comes from the patients. So you have a thoroughly integrated system where they can respond to COVID-19 very rapidly.
The U.S. has blamed China for the virus, undermined the World Health Organization, privatized vaccine development, and competed internationally for supplies rather than collaborating with other nations. How does that compare to Cuba's approach to the global community?
Well, you got to keep in mind that Cuba has been having international medical missions since the first days of the revolution. Since the revolution, Cuba has had over 400,000 medical staff serve overseas in some capacity. And Cuba has brought tens of thousands of people from overseas into Cuba. And so during COVID-19, when Cuba started to help other people, this was a continuation of what had gone on for decades. It wasn't anything new. After the Chernobyl disaster of 1986, Cuba took in 20,000 people from Chernobyl to treat them for radiation sickness. Almost all of them were children. There has been at least one doctor who's died during COVID-19 as a result of catching COVID from going to another country. And this sort of goes back to Che. Che and Fidel both emphasized right after the revolution that it was, they called it a sacred duty of doctors to provide health for people. And when Ebola hit Africa, other countries sent money. Cuba sent doctors. Cuba has a culture that it's the responsibility of doctors to help people.
What is an important lesson that the world can learn from Cuba's approach to COVID-19?
We're all in one world. If a pandemic strikes one part of the world, the chances are very likely that it's going to hit other parts of the world. You can see that inside the United States. If low-income people are not cared for, and as a result of that, get COVID-19, because of the conditions in which people live, everybody is exposed more. Now everybody travels around the world all the time. So if we do not help other countries, then we are putting ourselves at risk. Selfishness is a very, very bad idea when it comes to medical care.
Don Fitz, appreciations for your insights and inspiration. A few final thoughts. What does it say when Cuba can offer the world an effective model for containing a global pandemic with just a fraction of the resources of the United States, but a priority on the health of every human being? What does it say that Cuba has accomplished this despite 60 years of blockades, sanctions, and ruthless U.S. attacks? Perhaps if the U.S. empire wasn't working so hard to undermine the Cuban Revolution, it might learn some things from Che and the Cuban people that could save millions of lives. Reporting for Pacifica, I'm Ken Yale.
George Floyd's longtime friends are founders of 88 Chomp, a new nonprofit dedicated to honoring his legacy by advocating for families and individuals. George Floyd was killed by former police officer Derek Chauvin, who posted a $1 million bail and was released from custody in October 2020. He was allowed to leave the state while he awaits trial, according to a new bail conditions outlined in court records. And now we hear from two of the co-founders of 88 Chomp, Herbert Mouton and Jonathan Ville.
We're having a conversation with George Floyd's teammates, Brother Herbert Mouton, and Brother Jonathan Ville is on with us from
Oklahoma City.
All right, Oklahoma City. We all witnessed the killing of George Floyd all over the world. We're still mourning collectively. What prompted you to create an initiative in honor of George Floyd?
Our main two initiatives that we're actually working on as we speak is voters registration and law enforcement engagement with the community. We want to carry on Floyd's legacy, number one, in a positive manner. Number two, we don't want this to happen to anyone, no matter what nationality or race they are. We need to encourage those people. Number one, voting is very important. Number two, not only do we have to pay attention to the voting at the presidential level, but we also have to pay more attention to the voting at the local level, the immediate effect that it have on our community. Going into the law enforcement, we need to understand as citizens, what do law enforcement expect from us? And we need to let the law enforcement know what we expect from them. We need to be more knowledgeable of policies, procedures, and laws. So those are two of our main initiatives. We also want to bring in the neighbor back in the hood, the MLK Center that's on Sampson that's been closed down for over 30 years. That was basically a daycare and an after-school center for our kids in the neighborhood. Where do our kids have to go after school? We're trying to bring those things back in.
Brother Jonathan.
I would echo a lot of what Herbert said. I really think about how we kind of started coming together. As I was traveling back to Oklahoma City from Houston after the funeral, I just still had this void in my mind and my heart, not having a level of closure. It wasn't until, I reached out to Herbert and then Vaughn and Gerald that they were feeling the same way. And it was like, okay, guys, we can't just continue to talk about the problem, but we got to be a part of the solution. We have many initiatives. These two are so germane right now to the climate of where our society is. Not only people registered, but educating them as well on who to vote for, how to ask the proper questions to those who are running for a specific position, and then also getting to the polls. It's not just getting up to register, it's not just enough getting up to be educated about the respect of candidates, but you have to vote. You have to exercise your rights. So many people over the years, my forefathers, aunties, our uncles, our grandparents, former civic and community leaders, they sacrificed so much in order that we may have the right to exercise our voice by voting. We want to do all we can to not only get out there and get people registered and marketed, to just continue to let people know that they can vote. They can have their voice be heard in a strong and powerful way.
What do you say to people out there comment about, we've been voting since the Voting Rights Bill was passed, and we don't see change fast enough?
When you think about the systems that are in place, and you think about systemic racism and biases, they didn't happen overnight. It won't be overnight for us to get out of that. I've been using the phrase when people ask that question, that we have to understand that this is not a sprint, but it's a marathon. What the system is designed to do is to wait us out. It's designed for us to have emotional fatigue. We have to understand, even though I talked about getting registered to vote and educate them and then voting, you also, when those elected officials are in office, hold them accountable. to the things that they said on their platform while they were running. And if they don't live up to those things, you exercise your right once again to vote them out. That's how I would answer that.
And just to kind of piggyback on Jonathan just said, it's about following up, holding them accountable. They're not accountable the same way we voted them in, vote them out.
You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy. Find out more about our work at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
Hello, I'm Cynthia Pooler at WCAA in Albany, New York, and I'm speaking with Steve Greenfield, who ran in the 19th District of New York State on the congressional level as a Green. And we're going to talk about why he thinks our country is so divided. So you just get off of a bruising campaign, Steve. What do you think was split right down the middle, 50-50?
Well, we have a big problem in this country in terms of how we operate our campaigns and our politics overall. And maybe this began, in the late 1990s with a business decision by Fox and MSNBC, respectively, to polarize the media and appeal to only select audiences instead of a general audience as a way of maximizing brand loyalty from their viewers. And then maybe the two major parties then continued that process. But we tend to run our elections on the basis of how we think of ourselves as people, as opposed to what actually needs to be done to keep this country operating effectively and efficiently and resolving in an expeditious manner any of the crises that come up along the way that we need to face, just like you would, if your boiler broke down in your house, you'd figure out what to do about that, right? And in this country, in politics, by and large, we don't do that anymore. We have one party running on, we're the party of patriotism, and the other party is running on we're the party of empathy, right? Without either one, without either of those parties saying that they're going to provide everyone with health care in the middle of a pandemic. Like, they're not fixing the broken boiler, neither one. They're just reinforcing how we feel about each other as people, our respective tribes, how we identify. There are many other manifestations of it. We're the party of Jesus. We're the party of oppressed minorities. We're the party of, and yet, the Democrats don't ever actually, implement any policies that improve the lives of oppressed minorities. They just keep saying it, right? It's a tribal identifier. And the Republicans do the same thing. And gradually people have learned that's how we elect people, right? Who we think we are in the world, not what we think is going to solve the problems of this country, or even just keep it running effectively. And so, nobody's voting anymore on the basis of, what they think to be effective civil administration. And there is nobody... when you looked at in our race in the 19th, which you just mentioned, obviously I was running on, my 10-point plan, of concrete solutions for the things that we're in the middle of. I noted in one forum that the Libertarian candidate, Victoria Alexander, was in along with me, that although, she is a Libertarian and things that she was proposing did not strike me as effective solutions, because a lot of the things we're facing right now are not market issues and therefore can't be solved with market mechanisms. But that's the debate, right? See, that's the debate. She was proposing things that in her view would work, would actually change things and work. And I was proposing things that in my view were the better systems by which things would work, by which problems would be solved. And we weren't invited to any of the debates, and we weren't, afforded any coverage in the media. So, you know, that's where we are, right? I mean, I guess solutions don't get ratings, don't sell newspapers. Only controversy and hostility and conflict sell newspapers or get clicks, you know, on the internet. And so that's where we are. It is an intractable situation, despite the fact that Joe Biden has won the single office, the presidency, right? The presidency is changing. But in the House, Republicans actually gained seats, you know, and it's interesting to note that all the seats they gained were over, you know, your more right wing corporate type Democrats, your more progressive, you know, Rashida Tlaib, Alexander Ocasio-Cortez, Ayanna Presley, they all won their elections. The people who, you know, they're in the solution model. The ones that were running on, you know, tribal identity, they're the ones who lost seats. Republicans actually gained in the House. At the state legislature level, not only did Democrats not turn any state legislatures from red to blue, but at least two states went from blue to red. This is, you know, everyone's still hung over from their partying over Joe Biden winning to have allowed any of this to register yet. So the gerrymandering problem is just going to get worse now that the new census is coming in. We've got actually more states controlled by Republicans than before this election. We got the exact, you know, we got one office. The Democrats were aiming to win one office. You know, Trump is a terrible person and we have to get rid of him. And since that's all they were aiming for, that's all they got.
This is COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. From the beginning, the founders of this nation were duplicitous. The role of slavery in building the United States has been hidden. Between 1815 and 1865, over a million African children were stolen and sold or traded within the United States. The founders worked hard to erase the economic significance of slavery, to give the impression of their greatest and highest ideals. Dr. Masha Adebayo of What's at Stake spoke with Dr. Ed Baptist of Cornell University regarding his latest book, The Half Has Never Been Told, Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism. Here's Dr. Baptist.
You know, the United States comes into being as a country whose leaders make certain claims about their relationship to ideals of freedom, liberty, and natural rights. And from the beginning of the nation's existence, critics from outside and inside the nation are pointing to slavery, which was, of course, a widespread institution in the European colonization of the New World, the enslavement of African people and also of Native indigenous people as well. People point to this institution as a profound contradiction, as something that renders the claims of the new nation to a special status, to a reason for existence, reason for their rebellion from the against the British Crown, as something so profoundly hypocritical that it can even call into question the ideals of liberty itself, and so just from the point of view of establishing a justification for the country, over time, the significance of slavery to that country's political, economic, and other kinds of strength, they've got to be reduced in importance and in significance. They've got to be papered over. They've got to ultimately be erased. Of course, that's in tension with the very profound desire of slave owners to make a claim to a special role in leading that country. So all kinds of deals get cut to enable those slaveholders to protect the institution of slavery. And at the same time, that's baked right into the Constitution with things like the Fugitive Slave Clause, the Three-Fifths Compromise, some implicit and at times pretty explicit acknowledgments of the so-called right of enslavers to hold human beings as property. To, on the one hand, erase this, and on the other hand, to support and provide for the continuation and even expansion of that institution. They're critics right from the beginning, and none of them more consistent or courageous than enslaved African people themselves.
How do we connect this erasure of history to what we're seeing in the streets right now in terms of the extrajudicial killings of African Americans?
Yeah, I think that in particular, if you're talking about activism against racialized policing, which of course has been a really profound and driving force of activism over the last decade, but it goes back well beyond that. It goes back to the act of running away from slavery, right? Which is a profound and courageous form of resistance to that attempt to control what African and African descendant people can do, where they can go, where they have to stay, et cetera. I have to say that, you know, there's always been more than an asterisk. It's always been a foundational assumption of white identity in this country. In fact, you could even, if you want to be really provocative, argue that it is the foundational assumption of white identity in this country, that that Black people have to be policed in a different way from white people, and that all white people have a share in that task. It is a constitutive task of whiteness, of white political and social identity, to control, if not directly control, at least to vicariously give assent to institutions that ensure that Black people are properly submissive, that they properly follow the rules about when and where they can go. And when that gets challenged, as it has been repeatedly throughout the history of the U.S., even before the history of the U.S., whether by Black people alone or whether by Black people in cooperation with Indigenous and white and other allies and accomplices, what we tend to see is that crisis is what comes out of that. We saw that in the lead up to the Civil War. We saw that beginning really with the Great Migration to the North, but sort of peaking in the 1960s, and we're seeing it again today.
Mm-hmm. So Thomas Jefferson realized early on that more births by enslaved women meant more profit for him. And he said, "I consider a woman who brings a child every 2 years as more profitable than the best man on the farm. What she produces is an addition to the capital." And at one point, Jefferson brags to George Washington that the birth of Black children was increasing Virginia's capital stock by 4% annually. So during the expansion of cotton plantations, the deliberate breeding or raping of African women became an industry. Dr. Baptist, how important was the breeding or the raping corporate industry to the growth of the early American economy? And what kind of psychological dominance did that impose over Black bodies as private property?
Yeah, that's a question with a lot of layers. And if I say to you, slave breeding, quote unquote, was a key part of the U.S. economy, there'll be plenty of historians who jump up and say, well, we have no documented evidence, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Thing is, we do have a lot of we have a lot of documented evidence of rape. We have a lot of documented evidence that white enslavers were selling the children, their own children in some cases, right, into the domestic slave trade. And more broadly, the children of women whose children were sellable, right, by U.S. law, which made every childbirth in certain ways the product of a kind of sexual violence, right? No matter who the father was or how the act of conception had taken place, right? A kind of sexual violence inflicted by white people on Black people in the United States. And likewise, people might say, well, that's, you know, part of the law of slavery, right? The so-called enslaved womb concept, which is in use in the colonies, you know, the Spanish ones, the Portuguese ones, French ones, and the English ones by the 1500s and certainly by the 1600s in the English ones. That concept didn't get invented by Thomas Jefferson, right? But he knew how to take advantage of it. Now, beyond the things that people are going to say to submerge what actually happened, right? Which is that millions and millions of women gave birth to children who were stolen from them at birth, right? Even if they were living in the same place, right? Living in the same house. They were, in some crucial ways, stolen, stolen property from birth. Perhaps more than any other country, the United States takes advantage of that that construct of Western law.
That was Dr. Ed Baptist speaking to Marsha Adebayo of What's at Stake. Special thanks to producer Lona Alliance.
This has been COVID, Race, and Democracy, a broadcast by Pacifica Radio and its affiliates. Find out more about our work at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Thank you for listening.